All right, so good morning. Last week we discussed judges. Today we will essentially see the last judge, Samuel. His sons, as we'll find out, were not worthy and did not continue on as, or were not good judges. They did not follow in his ways. And so after that, they went for a king. So today we will discuss 1 and 2 Samuel. Also, 1 Kings 1 through 2, simply because that talks about the death of David. And parallel to that is 1 Chronicles 10 through 29. So we will discuss that briefly. The basic idea here, if you look at the outline, is this. You've got, in 1 Samuel, you've got essentially the introduction of Samuel. It starts with Eli, but the story really centers around Samuel, the little boy. Samuel grows up and becomes a judge, a very well-respected judge, a judge that follows God faithfully and does really well and lives for quite some time. Now, they ask Samuel for a king. This is in chapters 8 through 10. Then Saul's pretty okay. Then Saul's pretty bad. And then we get David because Saul was bad. And then you've got Saul versus David until, at the end of the book, Saul is dead. At the beginning of 2 Samuel, you've got David ultimately becoming king after a short war of succession. Short meaning it's not that long in the text, it's a few years long. And then David, the majority of the book, is actually David being bad. Now the difference is between him and Saul is David was not rejected by God. But David has all sorts of issues, and so we'll go through those. And finally, in 1 Kings, 1 2 chapters, there's the death of David. 1 and 2 Samuel, you really should consider them as one book. They were originally one book. They got split up because they were too long. Somebody said it was because the Septuagint had to split them up. You are constrained in the old world in terms of books. You can't print really small type. You're actually writing things out. And with Hebrew, at least all of our manuscripts, and people, I think, generally tend to think this goes back quite far. They are written without vowels, which means you basically get twice the text on a single page. And so you could fit 1 and 2 Samuel in a single book. Greek doesn't do that. And so it gets split into 1 and 2 Samuel. This book was actually called, this and Kings were 1 and 2 Reigns and 3 and 4 Reigns. And so you can think of 1 and 2 Samuel and 1 and 2 Kings as a really, really long book, a single historical narrative. Chronicles, which parallels this, was written much later. Okay, so this is after the monarchy period, that thing is written and is using 1 and 2 Samuel, 1 and 2 Kings, and so we'll talk about it some. By and large, it's an encapsulation, it's a summary in many ways, and so David fits in to 10 through 29 in 1 Chronicles, where David takes up a good portion of 1 Samuel and pretty much all of 2 Samuel. It covers a lot of the same material. It cuts out a lot. The only major addition that I could really see in 1 Chronicles, if you read it, you would probably notice this, is there's a long discourse on what David did to prepare for the temple. David wasn't allowed to build the temple, as you know. That was Solomon, his son. But he did, when God told him, no, you can't build the temple, he started gathering up supplies, gathering up people, so that when Solomon came to build the project, he could just do it. And that's all in 1 Chronicles. I don't recall that being at all in 1 and 2 Samuel. So that's how that generally works. Now, we've only skipped one book so far in the Old Testament. We skipped Ruth. Ruth does belong to essentially the period of the Judges. We'll probably next time we'll discuss it a little bit. We'll focus on the life of Solomon, which is only about half of 1 Kings, and so there's a lot less text to read. So I think it's chapters 1 through 11 or 12. Read that, and then the rest of the time we will spend in a large overview of here's the time period. I'll have a timeline. Here's how all the books fit into the time period, because Genesis through the end of Kings roughly follows a timeline. The prophets, all mixed up. Very, very much mixed up in terms of timing. So we'll put all of that together, and then we'll hit things as we go along. We've also skipped Job. Most people put Job, not necessarily in the writing, but at least the setting, in like the time of Abraham. And so we'll talk a little bit about that. Okay, so here's our outline. We've already been through that. Let's jump in at the very beginning. For those of us who several years ago, we don't know how long ago, went through this, a lot of this will be review from whenever we walked through Samuel and Kings. The book starts with Eli. Eli is a priest. He is not a priest at the temple. The temple doesn't exist yet, but he is a priest. And he's a pretty good priest, except that his sons are bad. And God does ultimately reject Eli in his ministry because he was not able to control his sons and did not deal with them appropriately. So Eli was a priest. Samuel was, at the very beginning of the book, Samuel is not born. Now, let me start my timer here. Samuel is not born. His mother does not have a child at this point. And so she comes to the place of worship and she's praying, and Eli sees her mumbling. He thinks she's drunk. She's like, "No, I'm not drunk. I'm childless. I'm praying for a child." He says, "You will have a child." And she does, and she gives Samuel as a young boy, as a very small boy, to Eli to be raised as a essentially as a priest. All right. Let's see. We need to be done at... So we have 30 minutes, roughly speaking. Okay. So Samuel is given as a young child into priestly service, and that's how he grows up. If you had Bible stories when you were a kid, one of the famous stories is Samuel... There, he's lying in bed and hears someone talking. He gets up and he's like, "Eli, what you need?" And Eli's like, "I didn't call you." And that happened several times. And he keeps going to Eli. Eli says eventually, "Oh, wait, that's not me. That's God talking to you." And so next time Samuel goes, lays back down. And when God talks to him, he says, "Yes, Lord." And God delivers a message, essentially, that Eli was going to be judged for not being able to control his children. So Eli is a problematic character, but Samuel is not. He does have issues with his own children, but he himself is not rejected by God and ends up being a very strong character throughout the first part of the story, throughout all of Saul's reign and part of David's life. 1 Samuel 1 through 7 essentially ends with an episode with the Ark. Probably recall this story. They're fighting the Philistines. The Israelites are fighting the Philistines, and they're losing, so they're like, "Let's go grab the ark. This will help us win." So they grab the ark. They go into war. They lose the ark. They get defeated, and the Philistines take the ark. Both of Eli's sons are killed. They go and they tell Eli. Eli falls over and dies. And Phinehas, you probably recognize that name, Phinehas, presumably named after the famous zealous Israelite from 100 years before, one of the sons of Eli, he died during the battle, and his wife gives premature birth to a son and dies. This is essentially the end of the major storyline of Eli. It's a very, very sad end. Well, the ark is taken into Philistine territory. The Philistines are either given hemorrhoids or tumors. It's not clear because they have the ark, and the ark plays all sorts of tricks on their idols, making them fall down in front of the ark and so forth. And so eventually the Philistines get tired of the God of Israel messing with their idols and giving them either hemorrhoids or tumors. And they send away the ark. They put it on a cart to be drawn by some cows. And they're like, "Let's see where it goes." It goes straight back to Israel. And so that's how Israel gets the ark back. It doesn't go to Jerusalem. At this point, Jerusalem is not a big deal. It is not a major city. It goes to Kiriath-Jearim, I believe is how you say the city's name. And it's going to stay there until David comes and gets it later. So in our next section, in 8 through 10, the people come to Samuel. They like Samuel. They respect Samuel. Samuel is very well respected by the people. But they see his sons. And the stated reason is, "Your sons aren't like you." Okay? And think about it this way. Your people, you're being oppressed by the Philistines. You've just been defeated. How does God deliver his people? Well, he gives them judges, competent judges. His sons are not competent judges, so they don't trust his sons to lead when Samuel's dead. So they come to him and say, your sons, they don't follow God like you do. Give us a king. Give us a ruler that can lead us, who can obviously defeat the Philistines. Samuel says, this is a terrible idea. One, God doesn't want it that way. And two, if you have a king, he's going to take your sons as his troops. He's going to take your daughters to work in his palace. He's going to tax you. This is not going to be good for you. And they're like, no, we want a king. Very wise advice from Samuel. As some people say, power corrupts and absolute power corrupts absolutely. That is a principle that Samuel is enunciating there. You give that much power into the hands of a single man in Israel, and he's going to take over. And he's going to take whoever he wants and do whatever he wants. So that principle is actually a pretty good biblical principle. Okay, so he says, but fine, I will give you a king. And when he talks to God about it, God says, they're not really rejecting you, Samuel. They like Samuel. They're rejecting me. They're rejecting God. Because that is not how God intended to work with them. But they decide to give the people a king. Now the king they choose is Saul. If you read the text, what are his qualifications? He's tall, he's good looking, and he's actually from a rich family. He says at one point that he's not, but another part of the text says he is. So he's actually a rich, tall, good-looking guy. So he becomes the king. What tribe is he from? Benjamin. What was the tribe we had major problems with at the end of Judges? Benjamin. Perhaps a bad sign. As it turns out, it was. For a little while, he is a good and successful king. At this point, we're here. He defeats some of Israelites' enemies. He does well against them. But then he goes bad. Okay. First of all, there's really a number of things he does wrong throughout his reign. One, he offers a bad sacrifice. You may remember this story. He's going to go up against the enemy. Samuel says, wait for me. When I get there, I will give a sacrifice. And then you can go into battle. Samuel doesn't show up on time. Saul gets impatient, offers the sacrifice himself. Samuel shows up right after that and says, you should have waited. God is now rejecting you as king. That was not all he did. Shortly after that, he made a rash vow. He's fighting the enemy. He's like, we're going to kill these guys. And if anyone eats any food before we kill them, he's cursed. Well, Jonathan, his own son, by the way, this whole passage mentions all three of my children's names. David marries Abigail, Samuel, obviously the prophet, and Jonathan, Saul's son. Anyway, I wonder if Catherine's bringing that up in their class. Anyway, Jonathan has not heard this news. Jonathan's a good guy throughout all these stories. Jonathan is a very good character. Comes to a tragic end, but a very good character. He doesn't know about this. He's walking through the woods, eats essentially some honey, and there's an episode where Saul is like, okay, I basically cursed you, and the people talk Saul out of doing anything rash. Still, it's bad. It's a bad move on Saul's part. You know, maybe you shouldn't make any vows. I believe Jesus talked about that at some point. It can get you into bad places, just like potentially Jephthah, as we discussed last time. Next, this is a great scene. This would work great in a movie. There's lots of scenes here that would work great in a movie. Saul's at war with the Amalekites. He is supposed to go into a religious war with them. And he's supposed to kill everybody. He's supposed to kill all the crops. He's supposed to burn absolutely everything. But he doesn't do that. He saves the best stuff. And he saves the king, Agag. And brings them all back to the camp. Now Samuel shows up and he's like, What's this I hear? I hear sheep. Why are there sheep? He's like, we saved them for sacrifice. And he's like, no, God told you to kill everything. God wants obedience more than he wants sacrifice. And then Samuel sees Agag, and so he's berating Saul and Agag. You know, the text says, okay, maybe I'll be okay. They bring Agag out, and Agag's like, okay, the time of my danger is over. It's totally fine. Samuel picks up a sword and hacks Agag to pieces, which Saul was supposed to do. But Samuel, in obedience, says no, and then hacks him to pieces. Here's, once again, Saul is a bad king. So Saul is now rejected. We are now in 1 Samuel 16 through 18. You've all heard the story of two of these stories about David. First is about his anointing. Samuel comes to Jesse's house, his father, and Jesse brings all of his sons, except for David, in front of Samuel. You know, obviously we'll start with the oldest son, because he's supposed to get the lion's share of the inheritance. And Samuel's like, this guy. And God's like, no, not that guy. And they go through all the sons of Jesse. And Samuel's like, you know, I was supposed to anoint somebody here. You told me no on all of them. So Jesse, is there another son? There's like, yeah, David, the kid. He's out in the field messing with the sheep. And they bring him in. God says, that's the guy. Okay? Kind of ruddy, handsome young man. But that's the guy. And so Samuel anoints David. Now, David does not become king at this point. Okay? It will be quite a while before David becomes king. Saul is still very much alive. Okay? And so David knows this is going to happen, but it's not going to happen for a while. The next story is David and Goliath. You've got David going and visiting his brothers. He's basically bringing him some food, and the Israelites are on one ridge, and the Philistines are on the other ridge, and then there's Goliath from Gath. He's standing in the middle. He's a giant, huge dude. He could hold a huge spear. He's got a huge shield. He's like, hey, one of you guys come out and fight me, and if you win the battle. If I win, I win the battle. And all the Israelites are afraid to go out and fight this huge dude. Well, David's like, how can this uncircumcised Philistine talk this way? And he ultimately goes out with just a slingshot, because he can't wear Saul's armor. Ultimately, with just a slingshot, goes out and kills Goliath. He doesn't have a sword, so he takes Goliath's sword and cuts Goliath's head off. And that's the story of David and Goliath. After this, you start getting a lot of jealousy. And now we're really getting into 19 through 31, this long period of Saul versus David. All the women, and if you're Saul, you don't like this. All the women are singing the songs. Saul has killed his thousands, but David has killed his 10,000s. And so Saul starts getting very jealous of this. He's like, I'm the king. What's not this guy? You should be praising me. You also have in this time period where you have the story of an evil spirit comes upon Saul. So you've got Saul with serious emotional and or mental problems leading the country. This is obviously not good. David ultimately has to flee after several attempts on his life by Saul. While he's fleeing and Saul is trying to pursue him, David is the opposite of Saul. Saul is moody and dangerous and bad. David gets multiple opportunities to kill Saul in the war, in all of this trouble. But he doesn't do it. Why? Because you don't kill the Lord's anointed. Amen. Right? Saul is still the anointed king of God. So therefore, you don't kill him, even if you get the opportunity. But eventually, this goes on. He spares Saul's life. But Saul is ultimately to be killed. He's in a battle, and this is towards the very end of 1 Samuel. He's about to get into battle. You probably remember this story, Saul and the medium of Endor. Samuel at this point is dead. Saul needs advice. He needs to fight these guys. So he's like, okay, yeah, Samuel's dead, but I need to talk to Samuel, so I need to talk to him while he's dead. So he made a law previously to ban all mediums, those who would talk to the dead, from the land. So he didn't know where to find one, so he asked his guys. They went and found one, so apparently his law wasn't particularly effective. And he has a discussion with the spirit, the dead spirit of Samuel. And Samuel says, you know what? You're going to die. you're going to die in this battle. And sure enough, he does. He and Jonathan are both killed here at the end of 1 Samuel. As a side note, the medium of Endor, this, as far as I know, has no relationship to the forest moon of Endor in Star Wars. However, I did hear Bewitched. I heard that she was from, I didn't really watch this show much, from a place called Endora, which is actually, they said, named after the medium here. Okay, so not Star Wars, but Bewitched. At the end, Saul is defeated and ultimately killed. And that's the end of 1 Samuel. Now, at the beginning of 2 Samuel, you're going to get David becoming king. Now, we're not used to what happens essentially in these kinds of time periods. Every 4 to 8 years, we're going to change presidents. And though maybe it's slightly more likely now that when this happens, somebody's going to pick up weapons and start shooting people. As a general rule in America, we don't have problems when power changes hands. Okay? We don't like it necessarily, but we don't pick up weapons and start killing people. This is not normal for the general history of the world, okay? It is very, very common throughout history that whenever a king dies, there's going to be major bloodshed for various reasons. Sometimes there's more than one son, and maybe the oldest son should get it, but the youngest son wants it, and so therefore you have lots of civil wars. That happens here at the beginning of 2 Samuel. You've got Ish-bosheth, who is a son of Saul, who goes to war to basically take over after his father. But David is the one who is supposed to be king. So after a few years, ultimately, David does succeed against Ish-bosheth. Oh, and to get back to the character of David, at the very beginning of 2 Samuel, I believe it's the first chapter, you've got a guy who comes and tells David about the death of Saul. And he comes to him and he's like, and you know what? I killed him. Here's his crown and here's this bracelet. I killed your enemy. And what does David do? Kills him. He's the anointed king of God. You had no right to kill that guy. David being very consistent here. And slays him for killing God's anointed. So then there's the war of succession with Ish-bosheth and David. You've got Abner, Joab, those characters you might remember. But David ultimately succeeds. Then you've got David deciding to bring the ark, which is still in Kiriath-Jearim, bring that to Jerusalem. You might remember the story of Uzzah. When they were bringing the ark, Uzzah is right there with it to keep the ark from tumbling over. Well, at one point, the ark's about to do so, so he reaches out his hand to steady the ark. And is anybody supposed to touch the ark? No. And so God kills him because he was not supposed to touch the ark. Eventually, the ark does make it to Jerusalem. Though this causes, as you might guess, a lot of consternation in David. Ultimately, they bring it up the right way, up to the temple, up to where ultimately the temple will be, or at least to the city. So finally, open up your Bibles to 2 Samuel 7. I want to read this section, because this is potentially the most... almost certainly the most important text in all of 1 and 2 Samuel. And there's a parallel text to this in 1 Chronicles. 2 Samuel chapter 7. So this is David in Jerusalem. We are right here. This is David in Jerusalem. Now when the king lived in the house, and Yahweh had given him rest from all his surrounding enemies, the king, David, said to Nathan, the prophet. Samuel is dead now. Nathan is now the prophet. See now, I dwell in a house of cedar, but the ark of God dwells in a tent. And so David's sad about this. You know, God's ark deserves someplace better than just a tent if I'm living in a nice palace. And Nathan said to the king, go do all that is in your heart, for Yahweh is with you. It was actually not good advice. That same night, the word of Yahweh comes to Nathan. Go and tell my servant David, thus says Yahweh, Would you build me a house to dwell in? I have not lived in a house since the day I brought up the people of Israel from Egypt to this day, but I have been moving about in a tent for my dwelling. In all places where I have moved with all the people of Israel, did I speak a word with any of the judges of Israel, whom I commanded to shepherd my people Israel, saying, why have you not built me a house of cedar? So, I mean, it's a good gesture. God recognizes this. But he's like, look, if this is really important to me, I would ask for this. I never asked any of the judges for this. Now, therefore, thus you shall say to my servant David, thus says Yahweh of hosts, I took you from the pasture, from following the sheep, and you should be a prince over my people Israel. And I have been with you wherever you went, and have cut off all your enemies from before you. And I will make for you a great name, like the name of the great ones of the earth. And I will appoint a place for my people Israel, and will plant them, so that they may dwell in their own place and be disturbed no more. And violent men shall afflict them no more as formerly, from the time that I appointed judges over my people Israel. And I will give you rest from your enemies. Moreover, Yahweh declares that to you that Yahweh will make you a house. When your days are fulfilled, and you lie down with your fathers, I will raise up your offspring after you, who shall come from your body, and I will establish his kingdom. He shall build a house for my name, and I will establish the throne of his kingdom forever. And I will be to him a father, and he shall be my son. When he commits iniquity, I will discipline him with a rod of men and with the stripes of the sons of men. But my steadfast love will not depart from him, as I have took it from Saul, whom I put away from before you. And your house and your kingdom shall be made sure forever before me. Your throne shall be established forever. In accordance with all these words, in accordance with all this vision, Nathan spoke to David. God sees the purity of David's intentions and the purity of his heart and says, essentially, this is the Davidic covenant. This is, I'm going to establish your family to rule Israel forever. Your son and your house will always reign over Israel. Now notice some of the thematic and verbal overlaps with the Abrahamic covenant. This doesn't replace it. It actually is more of a, here's how I'm going to make sure this happens kind of thing. Right? They were supposed to get the land. And when it talks about the land here, God says, I'm going to make you a king and your descendants a king, and you will keep them safe in the land. You will, through you, I will ultimately fulfill those promises to Abraham. So Solomon ends up being his heir, and then there are heirs after him. Of course, we know when it comes to the New Testament who ends up being the ultimate heir, who is the ultimate son of David, who ends up fulfilling the Abrahamic covenant. It is Christ. It is Jesus, son of David. So this right here sets up this whole notion, this whole promise of I will make your name great, in many ways, like Abraham's. I will make your name great, and I will establish your seed forever to keep these people safe and to reign. And so this is the giving of that covenant to David. So you've got here in 2 Samuel 7 a high point. David's doing well as king. He's following God. He's given this promise by God. But David's not perfect. And he does tell David, your son will build me a house. I do want a house, but you can't build it. You're a man of violence. I want a man who's not a man of violence, and that would be Solomon. And so Solomon will ultimately build the temple. And we'll see that in 1 Kings. Okay. 2 Samuel 11 through 24, you start getting bad things happening, where David is no longer the ideal king of Israel. This starts with the story of Bathsheba. The story is this. You know, there are certain months where you go out and you go to war. There are certain months where you stay at home. The ones that are good war weather, you go out and you do war. Well, in the good war weather months, and also this would be related to harvest and other things as well, David sends out his generals and his armies to go to war, but he stays at home. Okay? One of the negative things about him staying at home is he's on his roof. And there's another house right next to his. He sees this woman. She's bathing. She's really attractive. And he's like, I want that woman. Well, this woman is, if this woman was not married, Well, he could have taken her as a wife. It would not have been that much of an issue. Unfortunately, she was married to one of David's men. But he doesn't care. He's, you know, inflamed with lust. He takes her in, commits adultery with her. She gets pregnant. This is not the end of the sin. Because she's pregnant, he needs to deal with the fact that she's pregnant and her husband was gone. So her husband was out at war. She gets pregnant. He can't get her pregnant while he's out at war. So he brings him back. He's like, go hang out with your wife. Let's cover this up. You know, he's not saying that, but that's what's going on in his head. And he's like, no, I can't do that. All my men are out here camping. I can't just go in and spend time with my wife while they're all out camping in the wilderness. So no. So he's being a very good Israelite. Ultimately, David has him murdered because he needs to cover up his sin. Now, turn back to 2 Samuel. In terms of movie scenes, this is another one that I think would work really great. This is such a powerful story. This is 2 Samuel 12. And Yahweh sent Nathan to David, and he came to him and said to him, there are two men in a certain city, the one rich and the other poor. The rich man had very many flocks and herds, and the poor man had nothing but one little ewe lamb, which he had bought. And he brought it up and grew it up with him and with his children. It used to eat of his morsel and drink from his cup and lie in his arms. It was like a daughter to him. Now there came a traveler to the rich man, and he was unwilling to take one of his own flock or herd to prepare for the guest who had come to him. But he took the poor man's lamb and prepared it for the man who had come to him. And what's going on? Rich guy's like, I mean, I got lots of sheep. I don't want to use mine. I'll take this one little lamb from this poor guy and use that to feed the stranger. Then David's anger was greatly kindled, rightly so, against the man, and said to Nathan, as Yahweh lives, the man who has done this deserves to die, and he shall restore the lamb fourfold, because he did this thing, because he had no pity. Nathan said to David, you are the man. Thus says Yahweh, God of Israel, I anointed you king over Israel, and I delivered you out of the hand of Saul, and I gave you your master's house and your master's wives into your arms, and gave you the house of Israel and Judah. If this were too little, I would add to you as much more. Why have you despised Yahweh to do what is evil in his sight? You have struck down Uriah the Hittite with a sword and have taken his wife to be your wife and have killed him with the sword of the Ammonites. Now, therefore, the sword will never depart from your house, because you have despised me and taken the wife of Uriah the Hittite to be your wife. Okay? This is the long story of the rest of David's much more difficult life. As Nathan says there, the sword shall never depart from your house. And that's true. David has to deal with this and other issues for the rest of his life. The child dies. He does marry Bathsheba. The child dies. She ends up having a son, another son from Bathsheba, Solomon, who ends up being his heir after a little war at the beginning of 1 Kings. But at this point, things continue to go badly. The next episode is the story of Amnon, Tamar, and Absalom. These are all people of David's family. Amnon has a sister, Amnon being the son of David, has a sister named Tamar. He thinks Tamar is terribly beautiful and thinks, you know what, I need to have sex with that woman. Well, he gets her into a situation where nobody's in the house, he's alone with her, and he's like, lie with me. And she's like, no, this is inappropriate. If you would just ask David, he would give me to you as a wife. Now, as you probably remember, it's quite okay to marry your within your family. In those times, you know, if you just ask David, he'd give me his wife. He's like, no, now. And he rapes her. David does not punish Amnon very much. Absalom, another son of David, is furious from this. Absolutely furious that Amnon did this to Tamar and that he was not punished. First thing he does is he has a party, he invites everyone over, all of his family invites David. David does not come, but all his brothers are there. And while they're, you know, they're sitting there eating, drinking, they're making merry, he gives a signal, and Absalom's men murder Amnon in front of the rest of the family. The rest of the family scatters. David hears a false report that all of his children have been killed. It's not true, just one of them. They're all ultimately safe. And Absalom and David have obviously very strained relationships for a while. Eventually, Absalom is not satisfied and decides to revolt against David. So he spends some time making good with the people, getting him on his side, and ultimately has a revolt against David. David has to flee from his own son, Absalom. Roy, will you get me some water, please? Thank you. I had lots of allergies issues this week. Anyway, so then you have a revolt by Absalom against David. And then after that, this ultimately gets squashed. Absalom is killed in this. This makes David very sad. You might recall the story of Absalom getting his hair stuck in a tree. It's a good story. There are other rebellions and other issues. Finally, there's the issue of the census. This one is mentioned in both 1 and 2 Samuel. Well, I guess 2 Samuel. And Chronicles. Bathsheba is not mentioned in Chronicles, that I can recall. Neither is the whole Absalom issue. But the census is God continuing his decision to punish David for his sinfulness, incites David, as the Chronicle says, through Satan, incites David to number the people. This upsets God tremendously for David to ultimately do this. He's not supposed to do this. David does it anyway, and God says, okay, you weren't supposed to do this. Here's your choices. 3 years of badness, I think it's famine, 3 months, or 3 days. But if you pick 3 days, obviously it's going to be very severe. David picks 3 days, and for 3 days, excuse me, the Lord punishes the people for David's sin. I believe Chronicles says 70,000 men died in those 3 days from David's misdeeds. There's a lot of debate on what exactly is the reason why the census was bad, but it was ultimately for God's reasons determined to be the wrong thing to do, and so David was punished. And so that's ultimately how the narrative in 2 Samuel starts drawing to a close. At the end of 2 Samuel, David is obviously very old, and at the very beginning of 1 Kings, David dies. And thus you have the end of David. And then you have the war of succession between Solomon and some others. But that's for next time. So that's it. Eli and Samuel, Saul's good, Saul's bad. David is generally is an incredibly good character up till the Bathsheba incident. And then David has trouble for the rest of his life. As God promised, the sword will never depart from your house. And so therefore, it didn't. And he was plagued with problems till his death. And that happens in 1 Kings. So, okay, so that's essentially 1st, 2nd Samuel. In terms of time period, this covered probably 70 or 80 years. We're talking 1000 BC, a little bit before, up into the 900s. That's this time period right here. Next will be the time of Solomon, which is a very good time. I mean, the War of Succession is not good, but once Solomon excuse me, gets that settled, it's all good. Once Solomon dies, though, you get the kingdom divided. And then you have a period of a few hundred years of many issues in Israel, and ultimately conquest and deportation. Okay, so we're about out of time. It's 10:41. We have a few minutes for discussion or questions. Yes.
I think it's really weird. I mean, obviously it's weird that they asked for a king, but the reason they did is because Samuel's sons weren't good. And so, like, let's just have a king where it's hereditary. Let's have a monarchy where the sons are always in power. But Because it wasn't necessarily that the judge's children would become judges, right? I mean,
no.
It doesn't seem to me like Barak and Deborah were related or any of those people.
Right.
So it just seems really not logical at all.
Well, they weren't being wise. I mean, that was definitely made clear by Samuel. This is not a smart thing to ask for. And they're like, no, we want this anyway. The people were under a lot of pressure at the time. When people are under a lot of pressure, they're often not known to be particularly wise. They're going to be knee-jerk reaction. It's going to be fairly normal. You've got the Philistines breathing down their neck. They're very powerful people. We got to do something. This judges thing, you're going to die, and then we're going to be in really bad shape. So, give us a king. They need somebody to lead them. Because from their perspective, this whole judge thing wasn't working out very well for them. Now, as it turns out, that was their own fault. It was their own fault because of their own disobedience. But from their perspective, they're like, this judge thing, we need succession now. Because when you're dead, we need somebody to immediately lead us. And if you have a king, you know exactly who that is. Because he's sitting on a throne drafting your people. You know exactly who he is, and that will be his job. It's like, you know, we got these people sitting around. They pop up when they're necessary, but where's the consistency? We want some consistency. And a kingship will give you some level of consistency.
And it's fashionable, right?
All the other nations have kings. This whole tribal confederation thing is not normal. You've got, during this period of time, around the general vicinity of the Near East at this time, you have sort of a power vacuum. You've got lots of little kings, but you don't have any major kings. So now it's a good time to build a country, and David and Solomon do that. But a few hundred years later, that's not the case. You've got the Assyrians, which are the big baddies. Egypt at this point is not doing well. That's typically in the ancient world one of your big countries. Egypt is not doing well at the time. The Assyrians in a few hundred years would rise up, then the Babylonians, then the Persians. But now you got a power vacuum. And you got all these little kings, and you got the Amalekites coming in, and you got the Philistines. We got to do something. Just give us a king, like all those other nations out there, and we'll fight off these Philistines, and that's how we'll be safe. When what they should have understood was their safety didn't come because they had a judge or because they'd have a king, but because they had God. And if they were faithful to God, he would bless them in their battles. But yeah, it's not a wise choice. And it's a good political lesson for us. Because that's the way it is. You get too much power in a single hand. If he happens to be a good guy, you're going to be in good shape. If he's bad, that's the worst. Because there are no checks and balances for a dictator. If you get a bad dictator, it's just bad. In every conceivable way. Now, in the future, in Christ's kingdom, what's the type of government? It's a monarchy. Monarchies are fine if you can guarantee the king is always good. Monarchies would actually be the best if you can guarantee the king is always good. You have a democracy, sometimes it's going to be fine, but you know, if you watch the news, you know not everybody's thinking particularly sanely these days, as ever, really. And so democracy works much better than, you know, I like democracy. It works pretty well if you compare it to monarchies, unless you can guarantee the monarch is always good. And we can guarantee that in terms of Christ. But what happens in terms of David's line? Even David's line, you can't guarantee that. Because most of the kings after David were not good kings. And so Samuel ended up being right in all of this. Samuel ended up being vindicated. Any other thoughts? Yeah?
There is a pretty powerful theological reason why the census was wrong.
Okay.
And that's just that God had said, don't do it. And I think, so he brings down judgment. It's kind of the same sort of scenario with Uzzah and the ark.
Mm-hmm.
God had given like specific instructions about how the ark was to be transported. And so the fact that David either, I guess the legal terminology would be knew or should have known, It's like, yeah. I've already told you this is how to do this, and then God has specifically forbidden it since it's taken. So if David devises another means to transport the ark rather than the one that God explicitly laid out,
yes.
David decides to take a census after God's explicitly said not to, I think that it's back to the obedience issue. It's just in your face, I'm going to take a census. Plus, it indicates in the text, I think, that probably the reason why he wanted to take the census was to assess his power.
Right. When his power is in God,
yeah.
Not in his numbers. And Joab, what did Joab do?
Joab said, why would you do this?
He's like, don't do this. And he didn't, in Chronicles, I don't know if he mentioned this in Samuel, Joab has to do the counting for David, but he doesn't count Benjamin and he doesn't count Levi because he's like, this is just wrong, and he just stops. So Joab's being a good character at this point. But despite that, David does it. And therefore, not only is David punished, but a lot of the people are killed on his behalf. And this is what happens when you've got a king, when you've got that first bit of when Samuel's talking about the king. If he's good, then that'll be good. But if he's bad, that's going to be really bad for you. And that's, even David, who is a good king, when he does something bad, a lot of his people die. Any other thoughts? Let's dismiss. Ready? Will you pray for us?